This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. It's so great to have you listening today. Last week, Apple made its latest major splash in the consumer electronics world when it unveiled the iPhone 6 and the Apple Watch that accompanies it. That's the company's modus operandi. It has the reputation for revolutionary design and innovation since the days it was co-founded by a pair of young computer prodigies, Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak. Throughout the years, the late Jobs got most of the headlines and had the movie made about his life, but Wozniak, known to many as Woz, played a major role at the company, designing and building its first two personal computer models before leaving full-time employment there to take on a variety of new ventures. Today on the show, we hear part of an interview with Steve Wozniak recorded on stage this summer at the Flying Car event sponsored by the organization Innovation in Milwaukee. Speaking at the Zelazo Center for the Performing Arts at UW-Milwaukee, I asked Woz what was in his background that was most responsible for launching his life of innovation.
I could go through a whole bunch of specific things that, you know, were development of my learning and being computers being the passion of my heart. But when I think back, almost it's almost a very true answer. It was my sense of humor, my ability, my wanting to play pranks, to have fun with electronics, to bring joy into everything. And for some reason, my electronics learning was so out of school. It was so different than what other people were doing. You couldn't go to a bookstore and find a book on computers. You couldn't find magazines on computers. They were just big, huge things that corporations owned. And I was just lucky to get good at it, but I never thought I'd have a job in it. Nobody else knew this stuff. Digital logics and ones and zeros and all these and algorithms and how software worked and registers. And nobody knew that stuff. You know, all the lights and switches on the front panels of computers. So I just had to keep it to myself. Made me very independent, but also made me kind of a social outsider. So everybody was talking the nice growing up talk, you know, you get to know other people. And in school, I was just so afraid to ever talk to anybody. They'd find out that I couldn't talk their language. You know, I was in a different world. They called me an electronic genius. I won the math awards in my school. I thought education was important and good. I thought my teachers were good. I thought my schools were good. A lot of times you hear from, you know, some people that are really bright and successful, and they just say, oh, school was horrible. They had nothing good for us. And schools do a lot, I think, to fight creativity. But the innovation for me just came by making little games of trying to teach myself tricks to be better than I was the week before, better than I was the month before, better than I was the year before, but to design things on paper that I could never afford a single part to build. And I made a game, and my game was, like, could I redesign a room, a building, a house, but use fewer pieces than before, somehow make it less expensive, and make very careful decisions. And you think, and you think, and you think, and you come up with tricks. Tricks of combining fewer parts to do the electronic computer job, and then you think of more tricks and more tricks. I got into video games, was very important. Went along with a sense of humor, things you enjoy in life. Video games, terminals to get on the early internet called the ARPANET, the early computer network. But every time I did it, I developed new tricks for that thing specifically. So, of course, I had a block of tricks up in my head that I had used. And sometimes I could reuse a trick, but usually I had to come up with entirely new tricks. So what I had better inside of my head than was a set of tricks to design things with very few pieces to be the best in the world, I had a method of coming up with tricks when I needed them, coming up with better designs when I needed them. And you just get used to it. It's like, you know, what's the value of school? One of the values of school is you get into some large, long projects, and you know that working at even one subject for an entire semester, an entire year, that somehow the importance of something big is you walk away with a body of knowledge. And instead of reading the books on how it's been done and knowing how to do it, I always went off to things that I had never, ever done, never experienced. And I wrote my own books.
How did you get past creative blocks over the course of your career?
You know, it's a very difficult question for me because in my spurt from when I was really in elementary school on, I don't recall ever having creative blocks. There were a few times that I did things that had never been done in ways that had never been done before. And there were a couple of times where I thought, there's a problem, an obstacle, and when I get to that, I will sit down and I'll solve it. And sometimes the impossible is impossible. But luckily, in all the Apple stuff, just serendipity, every time I had an impossible task and got there, I came up with a very, very simple, elegant solution. And, you know, I was learning what people had learned before me, maybe. But I'm very thankful also, as far as innovation goes, not having money. Because that forced me to always think, I want these things. I've got to come up with a way to build it that is so inexpensive, I can afford it with no money. And I had never done those things before. It was the first time ever. For example, we had a cassette tape, and you put it in a cassette tape player and read it into your Apple II computer. It put in tones, and the computer would figure out what the program was. But it took half a minute or a minute to read in a simple program, and that's too long. We wanted a disk drive, a floppy disk, where you could say "run checkbook" and it would load in. Turns out that Apple was going to be allowed into Las Vegas for the Consumer Electronics Show. They were going to take three personal computer companies, and we were going to send three marketing people, and that's not me. So, in our staff meeting, I don't know, weird ideas pop into engineers' heads. They don't go the normal way. I raised my hand, and I said, if we have a floppy disk, can we show it? And Mike Markla, who was guiding the meeting, said, yes. Wow. That means if I develop a floppy disk in 2 weeks, I get to go to Las Vegas because they can't go without me. I'm the only one who would know how it works. Now, I had never studied or worked with any disk drive of any type or any disk operating system, hardware or software, in my life. Had never even studied them. Steve Jobs got me a drive real quick. I studied their electronics. I saw in the end they didn't need 20 chips of electronics twiddling signals around. All they needed was one little wire that goes into recording and one that comes out playback, just like a tape recorder, and then something to move a hit across tracks. And I developed this little device, and I knew it wasn't a disk controller. I knew it wasn't really going to run a disk drive because it was only 8 little $1 chips. So I knew that this couldn't be a disk controller that could do things like financial stuff. So I figured, oh my gosh, I'm probably missing something, but I know it's going to let me play my games and do my work at Hewlett-Packard. So I designed this incredible thing in 2 weeks, working every day and night, Christmas Day, New Year's Day, got to go to Las Vegas, got it working, huge step for Apple, but the motivation was because I wanted to see Las Vegas, to tell you the truth.
And so that is the moral of the story here.
So motivation's important, inspiration and motivation, wanting to go somewhere, but then having skills to build it and get there when you've never been there before, you've never studied it, you've never read about it, I call that writing the book.
So that's a success story. How about failure? Yeah. How important has failure been in your career?
In those Apple days, every single project I worked on was A+. Everyone got finished. Looking back, there's almost no way to explain it except an awful lot of luck that the right parts were there at the right time. I had the right abilities and didn't tackle jobs that weren't impossible to do. Later in life, though, there were cases where I had, and a couple minor ones at Apple that came up, but there were cases where I sat down trying to do the impossible to get products that were small, inexpensive, and used almost no power from a battery, and failed.
How much do you think we should welcome failure as a means to getting to the next step?
I like to go around and say that really in life, all your failures, missing problems and correcting them, is all the way you learn every single thing, early on, And once you've got the learning, though, you're very skilled. But to get there, yeah, failures. In business, a lot of people like to talk about, they start a company and it failed, start another one, it failed, start another one, it failed, and then they hit the big winner. Now, in my case, it wasn't quite like that. I built project after project after project for myself, and they all turned into some small amounts of money, but they were just for fun. And then the computer hit, and boy, that was, real big time. You know it when you hit the home run kind of thing. But the others weren't failures, so it's hard for me. It's a really difficult question for me. I think that a lot of people, though, one failure is if you're building a project for whether it's software, hardware, or anything not even computerized, if you're building it for other people because they will want it, that's not as good as if you're building it for yourself. If you want it and you want to be one of the users of it, everything about it has to be so splendid and so perfect, something that you'll be able to show off. And one thing I'll tell you, you'll have a lot fewer failures if you're a business purse-minded person, link up with the engineers in advance. Because engineers are used to solving problems and being tricky, and they'll put out ideas for what your product really could be more than you can write on paper to raise money from capitalists thinking, I'll just hire the engineers when it comes time and I'll retain all the stock and ownership. I tell business people, no, please include the engineers from day one.
Well, and which has been harder for you, the designing and the execution of product development or the corporate politics as you got better at it?
My life, well, there are different kinds of people that are important in this world. I didn't want to leave Hewlett-Packard to start Apple, and finally I changed my mind, but under the understanding that I would be an engineer at Apple, and I would stay an engineer, and I would have stock. Well, you could be an engineer and be a manager and get rich. That's one way. But I only wanted to stay an engineer my whole life because engineers are true to their art. You have to design something. It has to be tested. It has to work. It's accountable. You're accountable for it. It has to work in the end and do things. And if you're skilled at that, I could never fail at that. Politics, on the other hand, as smart as you are, you can get into word battles and, you know, and decisions about what's right and wrong. And you know, and I hate the huge corporate, you know, the management structure and all that. I like to rather just be, get the bright people together and build things that are great.
How do you decide who the right people are?
Well, you know what? It's really funny. When you're young, like when we started Apple, it's very difficult to decide who the right people are because you have no experience in business, knowing what kind the right people are. In our case, we were very lucky. You always hear about Steve Jobs and myself. We were in our young 20s. Didn't even have savings accounts. We didn't have any rich relatives or anything. You know, we just had this product. But our funder, Mike Markula, owned as much of the company as we did, and he came in with a business experience. And he said, here's how you set up a technology company. Here are the positions that you have to hire, you know, at a small scale, and as you grow, what the positions would be. Here's what the responsibilities of a president would be, the responsibilities of an operations guy, the responsibilities of marketing, the responsibilities of engineering and operations and accounting and things like that. So we actually, at Apple, we hired a bunch of, like, older, established, more professional-type people. And then when I look back, I saw a whole bunch of young companies being started up by kids like us, but they didn't have the professional content. They really didn't have that part of it. So I think that was extremely important.
Is there a way to quantify creativity?
Quantify creativity. you know it when you see it? That's like art. You know, it's like music. Can you quantify music? Can I describe a song to you and you'll know if you like it or not? No, you know you have to hear it before you can judge it. Creativity is that kind of art.
Well, and I wonder if there's something to the idea that creativity is a little like a sense of humor. You can deconstruct a joke, but it loses something when you take it apart.
I've never heard that metaphor before, but it sounds pretty accurate to me. The little pieces of a joke wouldn't add up to the total of the joke. Well, a joke is art, though. It's like in the telling. And very often, creativity is art. These guys that create new things that didn't exist, in a way, they are technical artists, the same as an artist that's trying to compose some music, you know, that's new and inspiring, you know, and that's why I said earlier, it's like if you're actually an engineer or an inventor, but you're making something that you yourself want to use in your own life, it's going to turn out great. Steve Jobs wanted that iPhone his way. Elon Musk wanted the Tesla automobile his way, and that's why you get such fine products. The Apple II was really to do my work and my fun. It had to be. It was all for me.
Right. You can take the formula, but part of the formula is Steve Wozniak or Steve Jobs or Elon Musk.
Yeah, and there's inspirations. The way the head works is a lot different than the way the computer works. You can't make creativity a spreadsheet, you know, a function, a set of rules, because a computer can crank out things a billion times a second. How fast can you count numbers? How long would it take you to count to a billion? Would you ever be able to do it in your lifetime, even realistically, as a human being? So these computers are so powerful. But if you type in a simple little program saying, try every method to solve this problem, you'll find out there are a lot of really simple problems to us humans that the computer just can't calculate that way. It turns out that the method, coming up with the method, is part of human intuition. You know, I think if I can divide the problem up into something different and solve it, you know, a couple little smaller problems, that's the way to solve it. We are the ones who tell the computers how to solve a problem. They don't tell themselves. They aren't thinking. They aren't our level of brain yet.
Steve Wozniak recorded before a live audience at Flying Car Milwaukee this summer. We'll have more of our conversation after a break on Lake Effect from WUWM. More of Lake Effect on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. We're listening to an interview with Apple co-founder Steve Wozniak, recorded on stage at UWM's Zelazo Center this summer during Flying Car Milwaukee. The three-day event was organized by the group Innovation in Milwaukee. I noticed Woz's distinctive wristwatch with a giant LED display that flashed the time with each turn of his arm. I wondered if it said something about his approach to technology.
At first, I bought this watch because it was unusual. And I said, I'll go for 1 week and I'll show it to all my gadget friends, you know. Here's a new weird thing, you know, you got to see this. And the funny thing is, after 3 days, I'd shown it to all my gadget friends and I was going to take it off and just go back to a nice, thin, beautiful watch, you know, a piece of art that, you know, a nice little watch like with hands and a dial, a normal watch. And then I realized this watch is easier to read the time to my brain than any watch I've ever owned. Big glowing digits, 9:29. It's just, it's that. So technology, when technology is good, it saves you from mental steps of thinking. And you can feel how hard your brain is working on problems. If your brain isn't working as hard, technology did a good job for you. If it saves you labor or thinking. Learned that in the early days of calculators, designing them at Hewlett-Packard.
Well, I think that speaks to the question of which is more important, designing the product itself or designing the experience you want that product to provide for the consumer.
That's an excellent question. And it was very instrumental to our Apple experience. When we started Apple, our funder was a marketing guy. He said, we're going to be a market-driven company. We're going to understand the users, the user experience, what they want, how much it's worth for them. And then marketing will tell engineering what to build. And that was a mistake because we actually made marketing error after error after error for 10 years. We had kind of very little success in the marketing area except the Apple II computer. If I build a product, it's going to do certain things, but if I'm the user of it, am I going to be frustrated and upset? Is it going to not do the things I really want? Is it going to do them poorly? Or is it going to do things just so great, you know, that it really is insanely great, a whole new different approach that's much more adapted to humans? At Apple Computer, early on, we got in this mode that the human is more important than the technology pieces. So the human that you're building it for is really, what you've got to do is put your work in to making things work in their most natural way possible, rather than forcing the humans to learn how to use this piece of technology because it's so complicated.
If there's a rub to periods of intense innovation, it is sometimes that it is not always as daring as it might be. How do we develop an entrepreneurial community that doesn't just take on, I don't know, simple problems like how to share photographs, but rather one that is ambitious enough to take on big problems that affect a lot of people?
Well, you know, you can do something that has almost no meaning and no value, and if you love it in your heart, that's what you should be doing. You don't care about, I don't want to make big money. If your only goal is to make big money, whoa, you know, try to find solutions in life that affect everybody. Funny thing is, everybody does use photos. And those can lead to, you know, very huge companies, because once we had a computer, we found out over enough time that computer could be applied to almost every little problem that existed in the world. We do things today, everything we do with our mobile technology and computers, even if they're in data centers out in the cloud, everything we do with them, the old manual ways are just, almost always... you're scared to ever want to go back there. Once in a while, you say it was better before. You know, more than once in a while, maybe.
Well, and it strikes me, as I was asking that question about sharing photos, there were probably people that were sharing photos of us talking about it.
there's an awful lot of people that want to create the apps, but I'll tell you, the one's going to create the best photo sharing app is the person that absolutely understands it, that wants it for themselves, wants it in their own life. Whether they're, you know, the overseeing manager like Steve Jobs, or they're just an engineer like myself trying to build the greatest thing. That personal connection is so important, you know, and not just thinking I have an idea, a lot of people would want this, market research shows this, the numbers are that. No, you do have to have some real workers in the company too. You got to have some of the ones that know how to build things, and you got to have some of the inspiration. You don't want everybody to be a creative wild thinker, you know, and come out with wild ideas. That's one thing you got to avoid too, because A, they conflict. They tend to be very, you know, artists just don't quite work alone on the deepest part of their art.
You think we'll ever have a computer with a sense of humor?
Absolutely, but sense of humor is very strange because you can program computers to develop music, but when it's mechanical, we don't want to accept it as true creativity, true intelligence. You can program computers to write even poetry, and sometimes it can kind of read according to rules of judging poetry as semi-good, but sense of humor is kind of difficult. It comes from your human life. You're saying something along a line of thinking, step in a joke, and it leads somebody's brain off to the right, and then the punchline, all of a sudden they say, huh, there was a different path that I didn't think of. Eventually the computers are going to be conscious. They're going to have feelings. They're going to talk like us. I hope it's not for at least a couple hundred years, because that might give us time to get ready for it. I mean, well, you know what? If a computer can take an order at an airport quicker than a person, what happens to the person? It gets replaced by a computer, right? Well, what if the computers can think faster than the smartest people on Earth? You know, and actually formulate new ideas and explore science. I don't think we want that yet.
So in the short run, if you don't want to be rendered obsolete, become a comedian.
I like that. I'm going to remember that one.
What do you think we should view as science fact versus science fiction when it comes to technology in, say, the next decade? I mean, the name of this conference is Flying Cars, a flying car. We've been promised flying cars for a while. What do you think is fact versus fiction?
Well, we can all agree that some ideas of the future that are science fiction will not be achievable. You can't say anything that won't, you can't pick a specific item. But you can say that a lot of times they are so far out and extreme that probably humans in the lifetime of humanity will never overcome the challenges and create them. Science fact is what you can actually build. And it's kind of interesting. A lot of the science fiction ideas of the old days are really a real part of our life now. However, sometimes you have an idea, science fiction, and it might even apply to flying cars. And we would all love a flying car. You know, well, you know, what does that mean? That means, oh, I get away from all the crowdedness of the highways, right? That's the big advantage. I'll zip around straight to where I want to go. I'll save time. I won't have to sit in line behind stop-and-go traffic. Well, if we ever, here's an alternative, though, comes along before that. When I worked at Apple, I would predict the future a year out because I'm working on it. When I tried to predict 2 years ahead, just fiction, 2 years ahead, by the time the 2 years came, some new products came out that from other places that made it not really go in that direction I had predicted. So, like the flying car, what if you had an automatic car that just drove itself like a robot? And you got inside of it, and you didn't have to worry about the stop-and-go traffic, what's in front of you. You could read and get work done on the way to work in the morning. That would solve a lot of the problems the flying car is trying to solve, and it might be a lot less expensive. In the end, economics is a strong force, and it usually wins. I'd be the first person probably to buy a flying car, you know, because it's weird and it's different. But
your Tesla kind of flies.
Here, but it's an example of something. Sometimes when you work on science fiction, by the time you get there, you know, it's too expensive to build, too expensive. And prices of components, building materials, and techniques come down and down and down. You get a new idea, and a new material is found that makes it less expensive, and it's getting closer to where it's going to be affordable. Well, sometimes that alternative technology, the automated self-driving car, comes along and kind of, you know, beats you, and you don't need it anymore. Look at Blu-rays. Blu-ray discs were going to be so important, but they kind of arrived at an age when we were going to start ordering our movies over the internet. So it was, the Blu-ray didn't take off as well as, you know, expected.
As you said, you taught under the radar for some time, fifth graders, and I think you said through eighth. You still do a lot of work in the area of STEM education. What has your work with kids taught you about where creativity and innovation will arise?
Ah, good. For me, the most important thing about children, my own too, is creativity. And the minute they're born, you don't want to discourage creative thinking. You want them to feel that if they have ideas, they can act on their ideas. I, when one of my sons was very young, I used to hold him on his stomach. Wherever he looked, I took him. And he learned he could control the speed, the height, everything, take us through the whole house, a little flying airplane. But it's like he got to make the decisions. And then when he was a little older, I'd take him on my little scooter the size of a bicycle. And every time we came to intersections, he could choose which way we'd go. You know, at an early age. But I wanted to inspire that sort of creativity in kids. I look at our schools, and some come out creative. Why do so many come out just learn what I learn, and they don't kind of fall into the creative spectrum? We're born creative. We're born wanting to know about the world, open up every little drawer in a house, see what's behind a curtain. We're born creative to figure out how does the world work. And we get told pretty early in life, no, you can't do certain things, you can't do certain things. You have to go by a little maze and follow the exact track and formula. Schools are the biggest detriment of all to creative thinking because you have to learn the exact same subjects on the same day as everyone else, take the test on Friday, and of course, if Johnny's the smartest person, you start feeling very early in life, meaning around 8 years old, you start feeling that you are not going to be one of the smart ones and school is not going to be your thing in life. And the problem is you have to run a school that way. The kids in school can't open every little drawer to see what's inside of them. They can't go explore a technique, something they learned about maybe a star, and they wanted to go explore it further and further and further. The internet makes it possible to do it at home, but boy, in school, you just know that the test is going to cover certain pages in the book on Friday for everybody, and the right answer, you get told right away, you are smart, you are intelligent if you get good grades. But the grades are based on having the same correct answers as everyone else. And that's not your own answer. It's not you coming up with totally new thinking of your own. It's very hard. Some of the artistic type classes, even writing in literature, are a lot more creative oriented than our typical STEM subjects. So it's hard to be STEM and creativity. It's hard. How are you going to get them both? Well, if you can never fail as a student to be creative if you have one teacher who cares, one smart teacher who cares and will spend the time and will get you through understanding subjects and then also assign little projects that from your learning of this portion of material, learning some other material, learning other material, you on your own can combine them to make the end solution. You're not going to be shown the answer, how to get the answer in advance. That one teacher can do great, but we can't afford one teacher per student now, can we? Be too expensive. Except we can afford one smart tablet per student, right? What if the tablet, why have the computers in schools not put out brighter, more creative people after all this time? And that's what I see, and that's what I saw when I was teaching. I thought this computer was going to make kids learn using so much more of their brain because the computer can correct them instantly. And it didn't really change things that much because the school structure is the same. The really creative people in life, even the ones that started all our technology companies, a lot of them without college degrees. I'm the one who went back and got mine, finally. So those kind of people, they say that, well, you know, school was just an inhibiting factor. Everything important they learned that got moved the world ahead, we learned outside of school on our own, doing our own little projects. And how could that be? Well, one teacher per student. What if a computer had a personality like a human being and it was that best friend idea? Then young students expect guidance. So I'm hoping that computers with a conscience attract the kids.
There's a lot of talk about the power of project-based learning. Do you think that's a key part of this equation, the idea that kids are going to learn more by finding something an end that they work towards?
Project-based learning is great, and it is the solution. It is a super solution and at earlier years in your life. However, you have to build some skill set up in a normal way to some level without it. Project-based learning says you have the end goal. This is, you know, certainly by high school and middle school. You could have an end goal and be told, in this class, in this school, you're going to learn bits of material and you're going to be given books and they will have little bits of material that can add up to you being able to create that end solution, the end goal, the project-based solution. And the only trouble is motivation's a big factor. You've got to give a kid a motivation. And grades, salaries, titles, awards, those just aren't motivating. Like, you want something personal in yourself. So how do you pick the project is much more important. The project that will get one student so interested, they really want to prove they can build, you know, a skateboard with a motor, maybe. Just something simple like that. And going about it, they might even learn something about robotics. They might learn something about motors, electricity, a lot of different subjects all on their own. And they're going to learn everything it takes to get their own personal project done, especially if they think, oh, God, I can show it to other people.
Well, and speaking of that, we talked about gadgets. We talked about your watch. You are a well-known Tesla driver now. What's the latest neat thing that you've gotten?
Well, oddly enough, that I've gotten, the latest neat thing is the Tesla automobile. And I was very reserved. You know, it's an electric car. And electric cars have issues of keeping them charged and what if they run out. And I'm an experimenter. That's fine for me. But my wife is, you know, I don't want to burden her. And I've driven a Prius for 10 years, and we canceled our Tesla order. And we bought a gas guzzler instead. And Elon Musk, the president of Tesla, said I wasn't a true Silicon Valley boy. But he started describing to me how he had designed a lot of that car for his own family. But I said to my wife, we made the right decision. I didn't press her. And then one day, I'm so thankful I have a wife that understands me so well. And I never do things on my own without her. So she said, if you want a Tesla, you can order it. Man, that night I ordered it. and that car, you know what? I was scared that, okay, I'm exploring. I'm one of the explorers. I'm an early adopter. I'm going to get this car and I'm going to tell other people what my experiences are. Within one day, both of us loved it more than any of our other cars. We've already had 3 college-age relatives come out to visit us. And of all our cars, they like the Tesla more than the Mercedes or the Hummer. It's just an amazing experience of how a car company could run.
And of course, 0 to 60 in 3.8 seconds isn't so bad either.
4.2.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, Steve Wozniak, you've gotten us all charged up here. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you all. Glad to meet you.
Steve Wozniak speaking to a live audience at UWM's Zelazo Center as part of this summer's Flying Car Milwaukee event. Wozniak was, along with Steve Jobs, co-founder of Apple and has since gone on to a number of technology ventures and even some television stints on Dancing with the Stars and Big Bang Theory. There is a link to a video of our full hour-long interview from WUWM.com/Lake Effect. One more break, and then we're back with a fall arts preview on Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio.